I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's Mardi Gras. When else can you see grown men promenading around town in extravagant suits of feathers and beads? And the so-called Mardi Gras Indians of New Orleans may be the grandest of all. But there's more to their story than glitz and parades. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. But first to a matter of personal finance, one we think might be of particular interest during Black History Month. Now, many people these days are trying to shop with a conscience, which is to say to steer their consumer dollars to causes and companies that they believe in. That means different things to different people. It can mean bypassing mega stores for a local independently owned retailer to buy things like clothes or books. It might mean making a special effort to seek out businesses owned by members of your faith or ethnic community. Maggie Anderson and her husband tried their own twist on that back in 2009 when they tried to meet their family's needs by buying exclusively from Black-owned businesses. They tell the story in the new book, Our Black Year, One Family's Quest to Buy Black in America's Racially Divided Economy. And Maggie Anderson joins us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You describe the scene where you and your husband are sort of talking about this. You're going out for a nice dinner. You and he are very successful, well-educated. You have the means to patronize pretty much any businesses in the area that you want. So how did the idea strike you? Set that scene for us.
Well, it's a conversation that happens all the time, especially among folks like us, the educated professional class in the African American community. We keep talking about the social crises that disproportionately impact us, and we talk about all the problems we face socially, economically, educationally, our kids choosing gangs over college, all that stuff. But we never connect it to how we spend our money. And what was wonderful about that evening was that it was that typical scene, a Black professional couple talking about how they're going to give back to their community. And as always, we talked about it in terms of mentoring, of maybe giving more to our church, but never made the connection that just supporting businesses that invest in our community or employ Black people or provide role models locally for kids in underserved communities. We didn't talk about it that way until that bill came and we paid about $600 at this place.
$600
for dinner?
That hit
me. Mm-hmm. $600 for dinner.
Can I come next
time? Anniversary.
This way? Okay.
We thought we were doing something.
Okay.
Because we spent $600 in a place that has, we have no idea how they spend their money, who they employ. And what hit us was, you know, all this talking we're doing, what are we doing about it? And just by maybe going to a Black restaurant or maybe throwing a party at a Black bar or something like that, we could have been countering all those problems just in celebrating our anniversary. So we thought about, why don't we do something that would inspire others to start making these same connections, to start thinking about where our money goes, this $1 trillion in buying power.
It actually was much harder than you thought it was going to be, even though you live in Chicago, which is
absolutely
the center of African-American commerce. I mean, there are African-American, you know, hair care companies, Ebony, you know, publishing company and things like that.
Yes.
It actually was harder than you thought it should have been.
Well, actually, especially in the realm of children's gear, children's stuff, we really did believe that it was just a matter of awareness. And we also thought it would be as simple as just driving a couple of miles to the west side of Chicago. In the west side, predominantly a Black area, you have all the plight that we're hoping to counter by spending more money with the businesses. So we thought, okay, we'll do a little more shopping on the west side, and we'll support all those businesses that we know exist. We just haven't taken the time to find them. So that's what we thought it would be about. Not at all. No Black businesses there, except for your stereotypical fried chicken shacks, fried fish shacks, barber and braid salons, mm-hmm. and a couple of funeral parlors. What we've learned is that the West Side didn't used to be that way. It used to be that we had dry cleaners, drug stores, department stores, hardware stores, banks, insurance companies, all owned by Black people who lived in those Black communities. With integration, we were just so ready and revved up to prove to the world that our dollar is just as good as your dollar, that we, in effect, abandoned all those businesses to shop with those businesses who would not let us shop with them before. So in flexing our economic might by proving that we can shop wherever we want, in so doing, we abandon a lot of those businesses. The point is, a lot of this was our own fault.
Well, you're putting a judgment to it, which is one of the things I want to ask about in a minute. And if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the new book, Our Black Year. It chronicles the efforts by one African-American family to try to buy exclusively from Black-owned businesses for a year. I'm joined by Maggie Anderson, co-author of the book, and she's the mom in this family. You say that it's our own fault, implying that people should not have pursued these opportunities. I just want to just ask you about that, because there's a lot of judgment. I mean, obviously you're making
a judgment,
but there's also been a lot of judgment directed at you and your family for this effort. One of the things I found fascinating was that you got some local media attention for your efforts kind of early in the process, and it evoked kind of a furious reaction. Tell me about that.
Oh, it tore me up. We really thought when we were kind of planning this and putting this whole thing together that, you know, people wouldn't really see the impact or the story or the message that we were trying to convey by doing this for a whole year. We really did not think that folks outside of the community would respond as viscerally and violently as they had in their responses to the news media. We were called racist, the N-word, go back to Africa, horrible things said about my children and my family, horrible indictments on Black people, saying that the reasons our businesses fail are because we're not cut out to be entrepreneurs and we should just be happy with where we are in America, and just really, really awful stuff.
What do you think that's about? But I'm particularly interested in the whole thing about Black people aren't cut out for whatever. Well, okay, look at the White House, but we can, you know, set that aside. But what about the argument that it's racist? It's racist for you to try to steer your dollars toward African-American businesses in an effort to support them. First of all, what do you think that's about, and how do you respond to that?
We obviously didn't see it as racism, and we're not racist. We didn't come out to do this to take down another race or take down anyone's institutions or get back at anyone. That was never the spirit of the experiment. So we were thrown for a loop. Our point was, how dare you even call us racist? How can we be the racist when here we are in the era of the first Black president, and the Black community is the only place where every other ethnic group and white businesses can come and set up shop and thrive and send their kids to college and plan and fund their family vacations and set up intergenerational wealth. But there's no reciprocity for that. No one talked about the racism from the other angle. Where are the thriving Black businesses in Little Italy and in Greektown? If you really want to talk about racism, we should be looking at it in the other way. Unless we wake up, especially as Black people, and think about the money that we spend every day and think about where it's going and counter that with and balance that with what's happening to our kids and our neighborhoods, nothing's going to change. We have to bear the responsibility and be a little more accountable for what's going on in our community.
So no more Starbucks for you?
Well, you know, I was so heartbroken when Magic Johnson decided to sell those stores, because we were supporting the Magic-owned Starbucks. So, I buy my coffee from local Black-owned coffee shops, and that's just one of the easy things that people, especially the ones who live in places like Atlanta and D.C. and Chicago, you can find a Black-owned coffee shop. We call these, you know, no-excuse propositions. So little things like that we all can be doing, and it really can make a difference. We proved that in the study that's attached to the experiment.
Okay. Maggie Anderson is the co-author of the new book, Our Black Year, One Family's Quest to Buy Black in America's Racially Divided Economy. And we caught up with her at member station WCLK in Atlanta. Maggie Anderson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Fawzia Koofi has been a deputy speaker of Afghanistan's parliament, a first.
She's the first woman in her political family to rise to power, and now she's being talked about as potentially Afghanistan's first woman president.
None of this could have been foreseen on the day of her birth.
Fawzia Koofi was among the last of 23 children born to the seven wives of her father. He served in Afghanistan's parliament for many years, beginning back when Afghanistan still had a king.
Though daughters weren't valued, only sons counted. In the remote province of Badakhshan, the young Fauzia's life was comfortable, charmed even. It was a place of rushing rivers, beautiful mountain peaks, a home with a garden shaded by a black cherry tree. Then her father was killed, trying to broker peace between the Mujahideen and the Soviet-backed Afghan government.
I remember many of the community elders telling us that they thought on that day the sky has come down. It's like it's an empty world.
Barely 3 years old, Fauzia Kufi suddenly faced a life of hardship, but also freedom that her father would never have allowed. She's now out with a memoir, The Favored Daughter, One Woman's Fight to Lead Afghanistan into the Future. It begins, "The day I was born, I was supposed to die." Your mother left you to die.
Yes, you know, to give birth to a girl in Afghanistan is, and especially when you don't have a son, having more girls means your life is not completed. That's how it's regarded in Afghanistan. You have to have a son to complete your life. But my mother was not happy because my father just married somebody, a very young wife. So my mother wanted to basically gain the love of my father or regain the love of my father by having a son. And when I was born, they put me out in the sun. And finally, they realized that I'm about to die. I'm crying. So my mother, this was the time my mother realized that I'm about to die. So she held me. She always was telling me the story. But I think she gave me a good reason. She said I didn't want to have another girl to suffer as much as I suffered.
But it's interesting that I wonder if that bond she forged with you at that moment was one of the things that allowed her to encourage you so much when you wanted to do something that really nobody was doing. You know, you're in a province that's pretty far away and you wanted to go to school. And your mother was behind that.
That's true. My mother was always proud of that. She will always tell me that you will become something in the future. You know, my mother will always describe my childhood as a little red mouse.
Because you were so tiny at birth and then terribly sunburned. So you sort of were a little red mouse.
So I'm sure she would have been proud to see the little red mouse is now grown up. And I think her laugh gave me the strength to move forward.
Mm. During Afghanistan's civil war, back in the early 90s, and this is Mujahideen fighting each other for power in Kabul, and basically day after day of rockets and snipers and people dying, you managed to get to school. And your mother was always afraid you wouldn't come home.
Mm-hmm. My mother was afraid, like many mothers in that situation would have been afraid. So she will come out of the apartment when I come back from school late because there was no transportation. So it took me a while to walk. My mother will come out of the apartment with her burqa and tell me, if the class or school makes you president, I don't want you to be president. I want you to be alive.
President of the country.
That's what she said. I don't want you to become president. I want you to be alive first. But the thing is that even with all of that rocket and snipers and everything, still women and girls could go to school in Taliban regime, completely opposite. Taliban basically stopped women and stopped me from going to school. I could have been a medical doctor now. I could see in front of my eyes that Afghanistan talent and capacity, 55% of the society, which is women, are deprived of all these progress. And that was a disaster for the country's future. And that's what Taliban did.
When the Taliban were driven out in 2001, it would be women like you who stood to gain the most from that. In fact, you have gone on to, in a way, bring back the Kufi political dynasty.
That's true.
What do you make, then, of the talk, which is now quite loud, about negotiating with the Taliban? That seems to be the presumption that the future will include the Taliban in government.
It's a very important question. We need to talk because we are living in 21st century and dialogue and engagement politically is a solution. I know in your capitals, in your countries, among your public, issues like women rights, human rights is not the main reason you are in Afghanistan, but this is one of the achievements you have invested blood and treasure for. So I think for that reason, we need to talk. We need to go to a political settlement. But there is different definition of political settlement. What President Karzai would like to have is basically bring Taliban back, share power with them. I don't think Taliban would like to share power. Taliban have their own condition. They want Islamic rights of women, and living under Taliban as a Muslim woman, I know what does that mean. I think the office in Qatar is a step forward in terms
and
of...
And when you speak of Qatar, that is where the Taliban is now setting up an office, an actually official place to go and give them a certain amount of credibility as a political entity.
But we need to be careful in terms of not giving Taliban another political identity, because not many people in the world agree that Taliban are a political group. Many people believe that they are a terrorist group. So why should we give them an identity by having an office and increasing their access to Gulf state resources, to more money?
You know, Fawzia Koofi, you begin this memoir with something very touching. Each chapter begins with a letter to your daughters. And the letter is often to do with the fact that you might not see them again as you go out into the world as a woman and a politician. How much danger are you in?
I speak my mind because I would like to make a small contribution to my people's life. And one day when I wanted to go to my constituents, I received this news that my helicopter might be attacked by Taliban. So I, we have traditionally this tradition to put farewell letters. And I wrote this first letter to my daughter saying that in case I don't come back, these are the values that they should follow. One of that is to stand on their values, and if that takes their life, it's worth it, because, you know, at the end of the day, you pave the way for others to come forward.
Are you, the presidential election in Afghanistan is in 2 years. Are you running for president?
I hope so, because I think if we don't run, then people like the corrupt politician who don't have a vision for the country will always be leading Afghanistan. For the past 30, 40 years, they're the same politician, the fathers and the sons and the relatives and the brothers and etc. They're ruling the country. So we need to come forward, at least raise our voices.
Fawzia Koofi, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fawzia Koofi is a member of Afghanistan's parliament. Her memoir is called The Favored Daughter.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. If you head to Yosemite National Park this time of year and stop by Horsetail Fall at just the right time, you might see something spectacular. As the sun sinks low in the sky, the waterfall glows with streaks of gold and yellow. It looks like lava. Photographers flock to Horsetail Fall in February to capture this phenomenon. Michael Fry is one of them, and he's the author of The Photographer's Guide to Yosemite. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So to start, tell me, what does the Horsetail Fall look like when you catch that narrow window of this phenomenon?
Well, it's really an amazing phenomenon. It's this narrow ribbon of water falling from this high cliff, the eastern buttress of El Capitan. And just that narrow little ribbon of water is lit, and everything else around it is dark. And with the right light, that water can turn orange or even red.
When does this usually happen, and what is the cause of the firefall?
Well, it happens for only a brief period of time, right at sunset, for perhaps about a week in late February. The sun, very low on the horizon, you know, just before sunset, lights this one little strip of water, and the waterfall is backlit, so the sun is shining through it from behind. It's an ephemeral fall, not much water in it, but what makes it unique is, you know, that lighting effect that, as far as I know, no other waterfall in the world gets, because the topography of Horsetail Fall is so unique, perched high on this open cliff where it can catch that sunset light.
Do you get tired of taking pictures of it, or is it sort of an adventure each year to try and capture it?
You know, I think for a while I thought I had made some good photographs of it, and I was satisfied with those, so I didn't really feel the need to photograph it anymore, I guess. But, you know, the more I watch it, the more I just enjoy the experience of being out there observing it. You know, the photographs of Horsetail Fall are spectacular, but actually witnessing this event in person is much more amazing.
Michael, you were out taking pictures of it recently. Describe what it's like going out there to capture it.
Largely, it's a lot of waiting and hoping. You have to get there early because there's only a few good viewpoints for Horsetail Fall. And then you hope that the light cooperates. It could be perfectly clear and look very promising, and then the light gets snuffed out at the last minute because of an unseen bank of clouds somewhere to the west. Or, like it was last night, it could be overcast, and yet somehow at the last minute the sun finds a hole underneath the clouds and comes through and lights it up.
Michael, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
That was professional photographer Michael Fry. He was talking about the unusual light that can be seen each February on Horsetail Fall in Yosemite National Park. And you can see it in some spectacular photos at NPR.org.
We're going back in time now, nearly 32,000 years. Scientists in Russia have cultivated a plant from seeds that were buried by squirrels in Ice Age Siberia. The narrow-leafed campion is blooming again, a small plant with thin green leaves and delicate white flowers. It's believed to be the oldest plant ever grown from ancient tissue.
One person who believes the research is Grant Zazula. He investigates claims of ancient seeds with the Yukon Paleontology Program in Whitehorse, Canada. He joins us now to talk more about this latest discovery. Hi there, Grant.
How are you doing?
Good. So start by telling us about sort of the period and the place where these seeds came from and how they've survived all these years.
During the Ice Age, when massive continental glaciers covered lots of northern North American places in Europe. Places like Siberia, Alaska, and parts of Yukon were never covered by ice sheets. So this was a landscape that was inhabited by woolly mammoths and giant short-faced bears and scimitar cats, you know, these iconic animals of the Ice Age. And so that part of Siberia that they're working on has this amazing record of the Ice Age and the life and the environments of the Ice Age.
And apparently squirrels, right? Because I'm reading from the research that these squirrel burrows had perfectly preserved seeds.
Well, if you've seen the Ice Age cartoon movie, like you know, most kids have, you know, that little squirrel that's running around collecting seeds is kind of the star of the show. And a number of researchers across Siberia and in North America here, too, we've been working on these records of Ice Age ground squirrels because they seem to have been this amazing little botanist. What they did during the Ice Age times, 30,000 years ago, they ran around and collected seeds and fruits and leaves and stuff, and they carried them underground into their burrows, and they used that for hibernation. And their remains of these nests and seeds are buried deeply in the permafrost.
So how exactly did these Russian scientists turn these seeds into an actual flower? And what's novel about the way they did it?
Well, it's absolutely amazing, actually. They first tried actually just growing the seed itself, and it never worked. But they recognized within the fruit capsule, the seed capsule, there was viable cells of placenta, which is one of the other reproductive structures within a plant fruit. So they took that placenta and they immersed it in a growth medium, sort of nutrients and sugars and stuff to help it grow. And sure enough, it propagated.
How do we know that this claim is true? I know that you've investigated fake claims of ancient plants before. So what about this one sort of rings true to you?
Well, the fact that they were able to radiocarbon date remains from the nest. So they did a radiocarbon test and sent it to a reliable lab, and it came back 32,000 years, and which is consistent with other nests that are found at those sites. And the fact that they found it frozen, buried within this permafrost, and took it immediately back to the lab frozen. There's sort of the conditions that we can consider to be reliable, I think, have been met. So I think the result is totally legit. And I think it really pushes the boundaries now. What can we do? And I know there's scientists at the moment that are trying to bring back ancient mammals, extinct mammals like woolly mammoths. And in Russia, at these
really?
Same sites.
Could they start with the squirrel maybe? That seems kind of.
Well, the fact that they could get plants to work is a major step. The whole idea about bringing back woolly mammoths now, you know, it's all based on the assumption that we could have reproductive cells within mammoth carcasses. Because in Siberia, you know, every couple of years they seem to drag a dead woolly mammoth out of the permafrost that's 40,000 years old or something. And you know, now that we know that reproductive cells in plants can survive, well, maybe we'll find a mammoth carcass that has preserved sperm or eggs. So that's basically the first indication that this is actually possible to bring back ancient or extinct life in the permafrost.
Grant Zazula, he works with the Yukon Paleontology Program in Whitehorse, Canada. Thanks so much, Grant.
You're very welcome.
There's more All Things Considered coming up right after this. It's been a while since we've said these two things together, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and 13,000. The Dow hit that mark today for the first time in nearly 4 years. It fell back below 13,000 before the close. Recently, the market has been on an upward swing, as we hear from Ilya Meritz of member station WNYC.
The last time the Dow closed above 13,000, Lehman Brothers was still in business. Unemployment was at 5.5%, and Barack Obama hadn't yet clinched the Democratic nomination for president. Doreen Mogavero, a trader at the New York Stock Exchange, remembers May 2008 as the moment when the economy was just starting to tank.
We were going in the wrong direction.
Almost 4 years and one financial crisis later, Mogavero says 13,000 means something different. The stock market is now climbing out of a trough.
Sentiment certainly has changed, I think, in great part because expectations have changed.
Investors, she says, once hoped for a quick rebound from the recession. That didn't happen, and now they're adjusting to a different set of facts. While unemployment remains high, jobless claims have declined. Consumer confidence is up, if only a little bit.
People in general are starting to realize that this recovery is going to take a very long time. And as you become more comfortable with the facts like that, you become more comfortable investing in the market.
We spoke at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and the Dow had already topped 13,000. Mogavero says a cheer went out across the floor, then the index edged lower. Hugh Johnson, chief economist with Hugh Johnson Advisors, says an absence of really bad news is just as responsible for the rally as the drip, drip, drip of okay, kind of, sort of good news.
You know, we don't have bad news coming out of Japan in the form of earthquakes and tsunamis. We don't have real bad news. We've got some, but not real bad news coming out of the Middle East in the form of higher oil prices. That's a little bit troubling, but not as alarming as it was.
Those events, plus gridlock in Washington and the Eurozone crisis, helped kill a market rally in early 2011. Johnson says Congress's recent decision to extend the payroll tax holiday cheered investors, and they really feel reassured by the European Central Bank's decision, taken quietly last year, to pump liquidity into troubled European banks. Can the rally continue? Peter Morici is professor of business at the University of Maryland and a forecaster. He says stock market gains will be hollow unless they're accompanied by a growing economy. For too long, corporate profits have been the result of cost cutting, not sales growth.
Businesses must grow their top-line sales. And to do that, we need more reasonable growth than we had in 2011. 3% would be enough.
We'll get a good clue when preliminary first-quarter GDP figures come out in late April. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meritz in New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.